Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. Over the past week, protests against stay-home orders have popped up in state capitals around the country. The protests have taken on a distinct pro-Trump flavor, and last Friday, President Trump showed his support, calling to, quote, liberate Michigan, Virginia, and Minnesota. So how widespread is this sentiment that Americans are needlessly being ordered to stay home? And why is the president throwing his support behind the protesters? We're going to dig into that. We will also, at long last, talk about potential vice presidential picks for Joe Biden. We have heard your requests that we wade into the speculation, and so we will. We're going to run through some of the electoral cases for and against the leading contenders. And here with me to do that, our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver. Hey, Nate.
Hey, Galen.
Also here with us is senior politics writer Claire Malone. Hey, Claire.
Hey, Galen.
And managing editor Micah Cohen. Hey, Micah.
Hey, everybody.
All right. So we are going to get to everything that I just mentioned. But before we do, let's start off the way we have the past several weeks and check in on where exactly we are in the course of this crisis. As of Monday morning, more than 40,000 people in the U.S. had died from COVID-19, with nearly 800,000 positive cases reported. Now, that's just the reported cases, of course. Nate, President Trump said last week that the nation had passed the peak. Is that reflected in the data?
In terms of coronavirus deaths or cases?
Well, he said cases. The model that he was referring to said deaths. So I don't really know if he meant deaths, but said cases or what. But just give us some sense of where we are.
I mean, the reason I'm giving you a hard time about that, Galen, is that we may be in that interval. There is a lag of about a week, maybe a bit longer, but probably about a week between when, on average, a case is reported and when a death is reported. And that's just because it's an illness that, unfortunately, can take a long time to kill you. I think there is evidence as of last week that America had or was near the peak and perhaps had come down a little bit on cases. But then deaths, I mean, we had several days last week where we hit new highs. So this week we'll see now, have we come off those new highs? Have things gotten worse? But there are a couple of complications. Complication number one is that you clearly have a very, very bad regional epidemic in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, and good news, clearly, those states have turned the corner in a pretty encouraging way across a lot of different metrics, including hospitalizations, new cases, share of tests that are positive, and number of people dying. Cuomo just this morning announced a lower number than the state have seen in a few weeks in New York, for example. Because that made up like sort of, you know, a third to a half of the overall case and death count in the U.S., if those states turn the corner, you may see the national numbers drop, even if it's still rising in other places. That's complication number one. Complication number two is that you now have some states going back and trying to count deaths that they had missed originally. Those are deaths that could occur in nursing homes, for example, or at home instead of in hospitals, or there may be people that didn't actually get a COVID-19 test, but are presumed probable COVID-19 deaths because they died of influenza-like symptoms or respiratory symptoms that probably were caused by COVID-19. And so now you have some states going back and counting deaths that they missed before or think they missed before. How those show up in the numbers depends on who's counting, which states you're talking about, whether states put deaths in more than one category or not, right? But there may be a little bit. So like last week there was, for example, some spike. And on one day, it was reported that like 4,000 some people had died. That was actually because some states had gone back. I think New York City especially had gone back and said, okay, we missed a bunch of people before. We're now including that. And those all get kind of people saying, okay, all these people died yesterday. No, they didn't. They died a month ago or 2 weeks ago. And they were spread out over some period of time. And there's a big jump in one day because of the way those things are recorded. That's a very long-winded answer. The short answer is like, it's getting better in the tri-state area. Unambiguously so at this point. Rest of the country, we'll see. I think we should kind of wait for this week before declaring any victories as far as the number of deaths having declined.
Okay, so it seems pretty clear we have hit the peak and passed the peak in terms of new cases. Deaths, TBD, we'll keep watching this week. I do want to move on to this hot political topic currently, which has spurred these protests. But before we talk about the protests specifically, What are the data points or benchmarks that leaders are relying on in order to determine when and how to reopen states, economies, countries, et cetera? We saw that some European countries are starting to do that. Groups of states, Texas in particular, has announced its plans to start reopening. So what actual data are these leaders or governors relying on when they're deciding how to do this?
I mean, the premise that they're relying on data might be a little bit generous. Look, I think states want to see some type of sustained decline in the number of new cases. You know, they're clearly not going to open up if they feel like things are getting worse, right? And in most states now, we see a decline in the number of new cases and or a decline in the number of new cases as a share of tests if the volume of testing has changed or increased. You know, if you look at the kind of expert plans on when the U.S. should open up, then that's kind of one benchmark and maybe the most important prerequisite, but it's not the only one, right? The other prerequisite is, okay, well, we actually also need a plan for how to open back up without the same thing happening before that happened originally, where it begins to spread throughout the population. Every person who gets it spreads it to 1.5 or 2 or 2.5 or 3 other people, and then it goes back up again. I haven't seen, frankly, very many states or countries talk about kind of what their plan is to mitigate further spread. Instead, it's kind of taking baby steps, dipping toes in the water and saying, we're going to try to open up a few things and see, to be frank, and see how bad it gets, right? I know how technical you want to get as far as talking about epidemiological terminology, right? There's something called R. We've talked about it on the show, which is R is how many people every person who has coronavirus gives it to. So if I have an R, a country has an R under 1, that means it declines. If it's over 1, it means it begins to spread again. So the question is, okay, right now, some countries seem to have an R of around 0.8, which means it's declining but slowly. If you open stuff back up, then where does it go, right? Is it 0.9? Is it 1.1? Is it 1.5? Maybe there is some effects from the weather or other factors, right? Maybe people are getting smarter and they're wearing masks and that helps. But we all kind of are feeling this out and groping this out in real time. And it's not like anyone has come up with, in this time we've all been shut down, no one's come up with a brilliant solution, or at least not one that we can execute in the U.S. or any other Western major country, large country, any point soon, right? So we're all just kind of guessing and feeling it out, and you probably will see that, hey, some things were surprisingly not harmful and some things were surprisingly harmful, and we're kind of just kind of exploring it in real time.
All right, let's get into the politics here. So this topic of when and how to reopen has become this political flashpoint with protests starting off in North Carolina, Michigan, Ohio, Kentucky, Virginia. I think they've spread since, you know, last week when they started. Claire, what is motivating these protests?
Well, the main organizers of some of these sort of marquee protests seem to be, at least the organizers of some of the official Facebook groups, people who have been pro-gun activists. And I think the interesting thing is, it's if you look at survey data, something like 2/3 of Americans are more concerned that we would open up the economy too soon and allow the virus to spread than they are worried about the economy not opening up fast enough. But I do think you are seeing these vocal protests that have kind of taken on, you know, if those of us who remember the rise of the Tea Party, it's sort of a similar feel. So I think they tend to be groups that are rooted in right-wing politics. We should say that Republicans overall, depending on what survey you look at, tend to be either split or more in favor of kind of continuing with extended quarantine or shutdown rules. But these groups are obviously, you know, they are Trump aligned, and I think they tend to share some traits with Tea Party types in the sense that they seem to be pretty conservative and pretty tied to very conservative causes in the 2020 paradigm.
You mentioned that Republicans are either split or in favor of keeping stay-at-home orders in place. Micah, how much have we seen this become more of a... because this seemed like a consensus issue, right? People were afraid of the spread of COVID-19 and mostly followed rules and stayed home and so on up until now. So to what extent has this now become a partisan issue? And do we see it becoming increasingly partisan the longer this goes on?
Yeah, you would think so, right? I mean, this is why I said I think it was on the last podcast or on the one before, that what Trump says and does is so important because so many people take their cues from Trump. You know, one, I was reading one thing about the polling data that pointed out, as Claire said, right, Republicans, they're kind of split. About half are more concerned about reopening too soon. About half are more concerned about reopening too slowly. You see the most concern for reopening too slowly among the very conservative voters, people who identify as, quote, very conservative. That same group, though, if you go back a couple weeks, was also the group that was least worried about the economic fallout of coronavirus. So,
wait, can you repeat that for those of us in the back?
Sorry. Okay. So,
no, I get the point that you're making.
Okay.
It's kind of odd. So, wait, just repeat it.
So, the group of voters who identify as very conservative a few weeks back was the group that was least concerned about the economic fallout of coronavirus. And now is the group that is most concerned about reopening the economy too slowly because of coronavirus. So what does that mean? It means this is just becoming a partisan issue, right? And a few weeks ago, expressing concern about the economy was viewed by many people as an anti-Trump sentiment. And so that's why you saw those numbers. Now, advocating for reopening the economy as quickly as possible is viewed as a pro-Trump sentiment. And so you see that. I will just say, though, you know, it is a mixture, right? I think part of this is, part of these protests are partisan and driven by Trump. Partly they're ideological. I'm sure there's some genuine small government libertarian strains in there. Partly they're organizational, as Claire mentioned. People are, you know, these groups are trying to turn people out and organizing people. Although that's often brought up as a means to like undercut some of these protests. And I don't really get that, right? You saw the same thing with the Tea Party. Like that something is organized doesn't make it less real inherently. And then there are people who need work. There are genuinely people who don't have the disposable income to be out of a job. And so there's a real need there. Yeah. So I think it's a mix.
I think what's been so interesting about, I mean, Micah, that sort of upside down statistic you cited about the economy, I think kind of, I've been thinking about this, the sort of very conservative Fox News contingent during this crisis as basically just being a contrarian bloc. You know, it's not even libertarianism. Like it's sort of become the sort of retrofitted thing of whatever the mainstream media is saying, we're against it. Because I think there is a real concern in here, right? Which is that we will have to start thinking about opening up the economy because we don't want the effects of this to be even worse than they're already going to be. And there, you know, you're starting to see, you know, you'll read the Wall Street Journal editorial page or something, right? And that you'll see more talk about it, about opening up the economy on a different scale than you see like the Free Minnesota type protesters or the people, you know, there's some videos circulating today of these healthcare workers in Denver, I believe, you know, standing as and blocking these trucks of protesters. And it's really kind of a stark, I think that's where the Tea Party stuff keeps coming back up again and again because of the sort of the nature of the protests. But I do think that it's this pandemic has exposed some of the very, very hardcore Fox News conservative contingent or the, you know, the right wing interest groups as kind of like not super strong ideologically on any particular issue, but more concerned with contrarianism, which I think is really interesting. And like that has become, it's not really like a, you know, you'll talk to libertarians and they probably have certain views about this, but I think they're probably a little bit more complicated than what you're seeing in the protests in some of these state houses.
Yeah. And I mean, to Claire's point, we saw some of this with Trump's election, right? Trump had all types of apostasies on conservative orthodoxy and yet got overwhelming support from these voters who proclaimed to be ideologues, basically. And we saw that they weren't. The only thing I wanted to add, though, is unless I've missed something, there are some comparisons to the Tea Party that make sense. But in terms of scale, there's no comparison.
Right.
The Tea Party protests were massively bigger than these are, and therefore I think easier to read political implications into, right? Where these are still small enough where, you know, you can, like, not to be an asshole about it, but you can get 4,000 people to a state capitol to protest anything, basically. That's an exaggeration, but you get my point.
Why is Trump siding with these protesters? Like, we get that this is a very conservative, pro-Trump group of the American public. Why is Trump, you know, after saying, I'm going to leave it up to the governors in terms of when they want to reopen, saying, like, liberate Minnesota, liberate Michigan?
Because he's the ultimate contrarian. I mean...
I think we should let our resident contrarian.
Yeah, come at me. Come at me.
You're not a contrarian if you're predictable. look, first of all, there's a little bit of a difference between like Trump's actions and his rhetoric. Look, Trump likes to pick these sorts of fights. I think he thinks it serves him well. I'm not sure it does serve him well. I mean, if you look at the polling right now, then it actually kind of splits Republicans, whereas Democrats are pretty unified. And independents are on the side of Democrats for now, which is not necessarily the fight that you want to pick, if that's the kind of fight you want to avoid. So I don't know. I mean, I'm sure he feels conflicted things like we all do. But yeah, there's a lot of talk about reopening, but then the kind of deadlines get pushed back, and like there's not necessarily that much bite behind the bark. And so may that change at some point? I don't know, right? I don't know. I mean, look, to me, the whole fact that this has become so partisan is super predictable, I guess, but also kind of annoying because, like, the decision states have to make about reopening shouldn't really have a strong partisan component. Maybe a light one. Maybe, lightly speaking, blue states have been more affected, although it doesn't mean they'll be more affected in a few weeks, right? And maybe people in blue states are more able to work from home and have more kind of status and of a cushion, although maybe not, right? But, like, this shouldn't be hugely partisan decisions. If you look at kind of when states decided to close, it was partisan around the margin, but not as much as you would think, right? Maybe by a couple of days.
But there's a difference. I mean, I'm going to stick with the contrarian point and say that it separates itself from like actual ideological conservatism. Like you look at Ohio, for instance, right? Where it's a Republican governor and the state has generally been considered to be kind of on the forefront of the public health response. In the middle of last week, he started talking about, okay, how do we open up the economy, right? And maybe as a Republican governor, he's feeling more pressure from particular interest groups to talk about that than, say, Andrew Cuomo in New York is, because A, he's at the center of the crisis, and, you know, B, he's probably not getting a lot of calls from the Chamber of Commerce saying, hey, Cuomo, what are you doing? But I think that, like, this is going to turn into a partisan issue, I'm sure. But right now, I feel like you're actually seeing from kind of quote unquote normal Republicans, like non-Trump Republicans, a very different response. Like Ron DeSantis, a Trump Republican in Florida, has obviously had a very, very different response than the Republican governor of South Dakota, right? Like there are different, like you are seeing some, I think, I'm sure it'll be obscured in like 2 months and maybe these protests will have become some kind of snowballing conservative movement, you know, libertarian movement. I don't really know what, but I do think that there are still like quote unquote normal Republican governor reactions.
Well, no, that's totally right. And as Nate mentioned, it's not really a partisan issue yet, right? It's an issue that unites Democrats, largely independent side with Democrats, as Nate said, and splits Republicans. But that to me is the key and is why Trump is siding with these protesters, right? So one, just on substance, it's within Trump's interests, if you think very superficially, to get the economy open and running as soon as possible. Now, if we have another wave of infections, that's not in his interest, but you know that requires an extra step of thought. So in that way, Trump is aligned. But also, like, Trump is getting really bad marks for his handling of coronavirus. You know, his approval ticked up a little bit in the first few weeks of basically like a very minimal rally around the flag effect that has begun to fade. Questions that ask, you know, how much you trust Trump's handling of coronavirus, how much do you trust Trump on it? You know, he gets way worse numbers than governors. There was a poll in Michigan, for example, that found Gretchen Whitmer, the Democratic governor there, got 57% approval for handling of COVID-19. Trump only got 44%. So Trump has a problem here. And I think one thing we've seen in his response, in most of his responses to this, really, one unifying theme is him trying to absolve himself of responsibility, right? The more he advocates or engages with decisions made at the state level, the more that reinforces the theme that it gives him someone to blame. You also saw that with his rhetoric. Someone wrote this article about he really leaned into the rhetoric of coronavirus as this like silent invader. And that kind of rhetoric that nobody could have seen this coming, you know, I think he's trying to absolve himself of responsibility. So this ties into that.
But to that point of absolving yourself of responsibility, doesn't coming down clearly on the side of just willy-nilly, like open up Michigan, open up Minnesota, open up Virginia, liberate those states, doesn't that then make you the poster child for if states start reopening and infections spike as responsible in part? Isn't the way that you absolve yourself of responsibility by just kind of sitting back and not taking a clear side?
To something Nate said earlier in the podcast, Trump's actions and Trump's words often differ, right? But in a public health response, your words matter too, right? And so I think Trump has become so acclimated to the idea of say this thing to satisfy my base or to get a Fox News clip and then like do this other more normal thing. In a public health crisis, you run into, oh, what the executive actually says has a lot of influence on what normal people hear, because what they're seeing on TV when they watch it at 10 o'clock at night might affect what they do the next day. So this is kind of like the ultimate, essentially like accountability for his rhetoric problem for Trump, because he spent the past 4 years saying and doing different things, right? And I think that that's what's so fascinating about our politics having become so substantial is that rhetoric is no longer just rhetoric. It's public health orders. It's modeling behavior for your constituents or your followers or however you want to put it. And I think that that's what's so fascinating for Trump as a political figure in this time.
I mean, I do think people should be careful about assuming that there are necessarily a lot of obvious answers here. The obvious answer that almost everyone across a broad range of different perspectives and policy preferences and whatever else would agree with is that as of a few weeks ago, almost a month ago now, that we had to have these substantial shutdowns, because no matter what strategy you chose to pursue later on, that like things were growing very fast, you had to slow that down or else we were in a lot of trouble. Now, those various plans, although to be honest, they weren't all necessarily plans, they were kind of, you know, they were, hey, let's do this now, figure it out later. There are a lot of ways that things would branch off from there, right? Some people might say, okay, well, as long as we're managing the caseload in hospitals, then we can open stuff back up, and yeah, some people will get it and die, but we're actually just trying to flatten the curve and not actually stop it from spreading because it's inevitable. It's what Sweden's doing, for example, right? Although they haven't done as much distancing as other places. Some people might say, hey, we have to like kind of keep these plans in place for as long as possible, as long as we can, until we get a vaccine, even if that means 18 months, right? You know, some people are saying, well, we need certain benchmarks that we have to hit, and then we can reopen. Some people say we need to have a plan to test and trace and isolate cases. There's a lot of disagreement that branches off from the first same initial solution is what I'm saying. And so people shouldn't presume that having support for an initial lockdown of 3 to 6 weeks necessarily translates into a stance of indefinite lockdown without clear benchmarks or clear plans for how one might reopen. So I think there's kind of going to be a lot of pressure on both sides. And I hope it's not just kind of like saying the liberals say, oh, the kind of science is on our side and these Republican heathens don't understand it, because it's not just about the science. It's about kind of what preferences in terms of risk and what trade-offs are we making as a society. They are essentially political decisions, right? If you were able to shut the entire country down the way it is now for 18 months, then you would suppress the disease until you get a vaccine that would also have a very high cost, right? So what kind of, we've written about this on the site, right? What's the implicit or explicit price that you're willing to pay to save lives in terms of economic impact and stuff like that? And how are the decisions made? So there are like very, very difficult decisions, and they're more difficult decisions than the initial, we have to shut everything down for a few weeks, because again, you can shut things down and open them back up. What you can't do is stop an epidemic in its tracks when you had the opportunity to do so a few weeks ago and it got out of the bottle, right? I mean, we obviously things got quite bad in parts of the U.S. They would have been worse, though, if we hadn't put the brakes on last month.
Right. And to be fair, Nate, I don't think that the opposition to these protests is arguing that the country should stay shut down for 18 months. What I'm hearing is an argument that you need an actual plan for what you're going to do going forward before you reopen. That's what I hear as the opposition to stop these rules in Michigan, stop these rules in Minnesota, at least.
But to be clear, just to like hammer a little bit what Nate was saying, there's nothing inherently wrong with advocating to reopen as soon as possible. And there are people have written about this, but you know, there are when you talk about saving lives, there are saving a lot, you know, there's the question of saving lives on both sides of this equation, right? The longer you keep the economy shuttered, the more joblessness there is, suicides tend to spike. There's evidence domestic violence tends to spike. There are real world, really bad consequences to having the economy shuttered. It's really more, to me at least, when you're talking about Trump, a question of motives, where Trump is so transparent typically in not only what he's saying, but why he's saying it. And it seems pretty clear that his motives here are political, you know, which frankly, most presidents, I think, would also have political motives.
Well, it's also, I mean, reading through the White House released the Reopening America guidelines on Friday, I believe. And what was interesting to me was reading through it, I kind of thought it was a précis, like there wasn't a lot of detail to it. And I know that granularity of detail is something that a lot of Americans and particularly business owners are looking for. There was an interesting kind of public plea by the restaurateur David Chang on Twitter last week that I saw. And he was saying, please send me pictures of places in Asia or Europe that have already reopened and how they're treating restaurants. Like what are the protocols for what servers wear, how tables are set up? Do you have basically like spit barriers between tables? And it was this thread of people sending pictures from Asia of how people are handling essentially public protocols for dining. And I thought that was really interesting. And I think probably a lot of American businesses are thinking about how they rejigger their logistics for the next year or so. And I also think that in the US, some of the political conversation around opening up has to do with timidity, you know, where we say, let's watch and see what happens in Italy or Germany as they open back up. What are the procedures they're using? What happens? What spikes? And it's basically like, you know, learning from other people's mistakes. But there is a lack of, I think there's a lack of, people can't quite conceptualize what things are going to look like. And you've seen some people try, you know, Fauci a little bit, you know, Zeke Emanuel and his team have been writing a lot for the Times in the past couple of weeks. And you've seen other doctors kind of try to say, this is what it might look like. Maybe we'll have immunization cards. Maybe we'll, you know, whatever. Maybe it'll be all temperature taking. But there hasn't been a lot of like, just literal, this is what it would look like. And this is what the government recommends you do for opening your restaurant or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, it is, Claire, important to point out that while it seems that some of these protests would appear to be representing business interests, I mean, we know from our own conversations with people, the people that we work with, that like businesses are worried about opening up and being responsible for spikes. And they do want plans in place in order to move forward safely. Like we work for an American company. We're all thinking about how we're going to change the way that we work for the long term. And I think all kinds of businesses are doing that.
The American Broadcast Company, in fact.
Indeed.
Can I? Dun, dun,
dun. Or is that NBC?
I just wanted to jump back, Galen, to your question about why Trump doesn't sort of just sit back more, and therefore maybe that would lower the chance that he would be blamed for something.
And also the caveat that I would say, I'm not arguing that that's good leadership. I'm just saying that if his goal is no blame, then you would think that that's what you would do.
Yeah, of course. I think the answer to that question is that the cat's out of the bag on that already, or like he missed his chance for that. There were real problems, as we've talked about, in how the administration responded, how Trump and the administration responded to coronavirus. And the public, I think, is aware of that. You know, the one number in the Pew Research Center poll that really jumped out to me, they asked people, Donald Trump was blank to take major steps to address the threat of the coronavirus outbreak to the U.S. 65% of respondents said too slow. Only 34% said quick. That's like a really bad number. You know, that's worse even than his approval, which isn't that good, right? So I think therefore, Galen, like, Trump is in a position where the status quo isn't good for him. He needs to change something. I'm not sure he's going about changing it in a way that's going to help him. But certainly, I think right now, the American people aren't like gung-ho about where the administration is re-coronavirus.
All right. So this is going to be an ongoing conversation that we'll be having over the coming months. But we promised a vice presidential conversation. So let's have it. But first,
today's podcast is brought to you by Lightstream. Do you have high interest credit cards? Well, with a credit card consolidation loan from Lightstream, you can pay those balances off today by rolling them into one monthly payment at a low fixed interest rate. That means less money tied up in credit card payments and more freedom in your monthly budget. Lightstream's credit card consolidation loans have rates from just 5.95% APR with autopay, and there are absolutely no fees. You can even get your funds as soon as the day you apply. One listener said, quote, I heard about Lightstream on a podcast and was able to look on the website and get clear information. The application process was quick and easy. You can apply today to get a special interest rate discount and save even more money if you go to lightstream.com/538. That's lightstream.com/538. That's the numbers, not the letters. Subject to credit approval, rate includes 0.5% autopay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/538 for more information.
We're back, and the Democratic primary contest is over, and the vice presidential vetting has begun. Former Vice President Joe Biden said in the final primary debate that he would pick a woman as his running mate, which narrows the field a bit, but there are still a lot of possibilities. So we're going to run through some of the electoral cases for and against his options. But before we begin with specific people, what is Biden or any nominee for that matter trying to accomplish when they pick a running mate?
Highly targeted pandering.
Say more.
You know, I think, like, okay, let's take Biden's example specifically. When you saw him first say, I will choose a woman to be my vice president, I think you saw two reactions, particularly from women. The first was, cool, that means a lot to me, because when this all started, there were a lot of women in the race, and now they're all gone, and the nominee is an older white man. The second reaction you had, which I think sometimes accompanied the first, was, shit, that's some pandering, isn't it? That's some, like, women, we think you are also important, and we think you should have the number two spot, no matter what. So there's that level on the Biden VP thing. But I think, you know, classically, like, let's go back to Barack Obama and Joe Biden. It was supposed to, the VP was supposed to balance out a weakness of Obama's, which was Obama was young and inexperienced. Throw in Joe Biden, who'd been in the Senate since his 30s, who had lots of foreign policy experience. Great. He makes up for a deficit from your nominee. It could be a geographic thing. Like, you know, we'll talk about this more, but I tend to think Biden will probably try to go with someone who can maybe score him some points with key electoral college states, given the fact that the Democrats have struggled so mightily with the electoral college. But it's basically, you know, it's supposed to be a balance, ideally, for your top of the ticket candidate, with all the caveats that, like, they got to get along. You don't want them to hate each other. You don't want, like, a JFK, LBJ situation. You want it to be more like, remember when Romney chose Paul Ryan, like, the entire news cycle was like, Mitt Romney loves Paul Ryan because he could be one of his sons. Like, he's also handsome and young and accomplished, and, you know, like, there was this whole thing of, like, Mitt Romney really likes Paul Ryan. So I guess there's also that human element.
And presumably somebody who could step into the job.
Yes. They must be 35.
Yes. Okay, so does anyone want to add anything, or should we start getting into the names?
I think the I think people underrate the importance of the step into the job thing, right? In part because politically, that's kind of what a lot of people are going to be concerned about. With a nominee who is 77 years old, would be 78, Biden would, when he was inaugurated, at a time when death and morbidity are very much on the mind.
Wait, underrate how, Nate? Underrate how important it is to voters, or underrate how much of a factor it is in the nominee choosing?
I think in this election, that if Biden just went by the heuristic, who is someone who's going to seem like they're ready on day one, that might be the politically most savvy choice.
Yeah.
And that's conditional on this election, right? I'm just saying, like, given his age and the subject matter that, like, we're going to be debating a lot of the time, namely COVID-19, then people are going to be thinking about that a lot more, I think.
I would just recommend William Adler, Julia Azari, and Perry Bacon Jr. wrote a great piece for us for 538 on this. But usually in these choices, there's, as Claire was talking about, some attempt to balance things, whether it's demographically, ideologically, and a calculation about whether the person is, as Nate was saying, ready to step in on day one. I think the best way really to look at it, though, isn't can this VP selection win Biden this home state or help him with this region, or can this VP selection help Biden with this demographic group or that gender. I think it's more, and this is, I think, what Nate was kind of getting at, what does the VP selection say? Claire was getting at this too. What does this VP selection say to voters about Biden? In other words, the VP choice is really just, it's one of the biggest thing a presidential nominee does. So it's like, what impression does that leave voters with? The great example of this is Sarah Palin in 2008, right? Where John McCain picked Sarah Palin. Not only do voters have questions about whether Palin is ready to step into the job, but then they have questions about why did John McCain pick Sarah Palin, given these kind of clear, you know, weaknesses. And I think that really, because people aren't going to vote for the vice president, they vote for the top of the ticket. That's really where we should be looking for these potential picks and their effects.
I can already tell that we are running out of time, or we're not going to have enough time given how many, you know, potential options there are. So I'll just say we will come back to this topic, presumably. But let's get into the names. So the first one I'll mention is Senator from Minnesota and former candidate for president, Amy Klobuchar. Pros and cons. Give them to me.
Pros. White lady from the Midwest, which people might say, oh, he's like, he's giving a nod to the fact that, like, he wants to win back those voters.
Can step in on day one, right. Has clear, you know, clear, relevant
right.
experience.
Is qualified, isn't too, is kind of like the right age, not too old, not too young.
Yeah. I think the clear cons are she's white, so you'd have an all-white ticket in a party that is both very diverse and cares about equal representation and diversity. And also, you know, there's some questions, there's some negative stories about the way she treated staff. I'm sure those would come up. Maybe the biggest con for me, though, is like she just really didn't catch on in the, I don't know, would you say she caught on during the primary? Maybe a little bit.
I mean, she
maybe
did. She did better than 22 out of 27 people or whatever, right?
So did I.
By
Nate.
The way, Micah, I don't know that I agree with you that either Biden's team or Democrats, white and black, will necessarily see it as a con that she's white. I think you could make the argument either way.
We elaborate on that because we have heard people calling for, you know, Biden needs to choose a person of color. The African-American community did a lot to get him nominated in the first place. There's a debt owed. We heard James Clyburn say that he hopes that Joe Biden picks a woman of color. Obviously, that's only one part of the Democratic Party. But Claire, why would you say that it's not a con?
Again, I think it could cut either way, but I don't think it's necessarily an off-the-bat con, because you could also make the point that black voters backed a white nominee in part because they saw a white nominee as more quote-unquote electable. I think that's a thing I feel pretty safe as saying, like, was part of the African American community's backing of Joe Biden, obviously with the nuance that, like, not everyone supported him. But I don't, and I think that, you know, Kamala Harris, who's someone I think we'll talk about, has been particularly vocal about how she felt like she got caught in this electability trap with black voters themselves, right? So I think if we've seen a Democratic electorate that's kind of made quote unquote safe choices on quote unquote electability, I don't necessarily see them getting up in arms about a white woman.
Yeah. I mean, look, there's a simple argument for a Klobuchar-like choice, right? Which is that, like, Biden's strategy worked in the primary. It seems to be working well enough in the general election. And so why not just pick someone who is underscoring, emphasizing that strategy, like Klobuchar, who I think most people, whether they love her or not, would think of her as being competent and qualified. So, you know, I mean, that's kind of the simple, straightforward argument is that, hey, look, actually, we won this primary by quite a bit, and we won it in part because African-American voters weren't necessarily looking to pick an African-American candidate. They were looking to pick someone they trusted, and that's Joe Biden. Now, Amy Klobuchar did not have hardly any support among African-American voters. So that might be a different issue. But still, the logic for saying, hey, look, especially in these troubled times, whatever slogan all those advertisers are using, just having continuity of message so that if the worst were to happen, that you wind up with someone who has the same vision for what American values are and how to execute on them, right? I mean, that might seem like a prudent thing to do, and there maybe is a little bit of electoral advantage in terms of the states that Klobuchar would help out in. You know, Minnesota is actually a fairly close state in 2016 also that people kind of forgot about.
Yeah. No, that's totally fair. And look, I don't think that the VP selection, as I was saying earlier, has much of an effect anyway. So it's not like Biden could make some VP selection that, for example, would win him, you know, massive amounts of voters that he wouldn't otherwise get. What I would say, though, maybe the best way to put the potential con of picking Klobuchar is there's little chance that picking Klobuchar will help Biden with the parts of the Democratic Party that he's weakest with, which is the most liberal voters, young voters, et cetera. So maybe that's the con. But that's not much of a con, as you guys are saying.
All right, let's move on to the next person on the list, and that is Kamala Harris. So a contrast with what we were just talking about. What are the pros and cons of a Harris pick?
I'll jump in on this, actually, just to say, on paper, I think Harris is like kind of all pros and very little cons. To me, the biggest con is kind of where I was going with Klobuchar, but then backed off, which is just that she never really found any purchase for an extended period of time in the Democratic primary, which just makes me wonder sort of like how much appeal she has. You know, how good would she be?
Isn't the other con, though, similar to Klobuchar in that she didn't have any appeal with progressive voters?
I think there's more potential for Harris to appeal to progressive voters than there is Klobuchar. Klobuchar is a much clearer centrist ideologically than Harris.
But Klobuchar did, okay, we can debate whether Klobuchar's performance in the primaries was good or poor or somewhere in between. You can't debate that with Harris, right? She, despite a lot of attention, great candidate on paper, quote unquote, she really kind of fizzled out pretty badly in that primary, to the point where if you look at performance relative to expectations, then, you know, she's in that kind of bottom 20th percentile, let's call it. Maybe not the worst of all time, but fairly one of the more disappointing campaigns. And so you wonder if, hey, maybe there's just something about her, and maybe it does have to do with her race and gender that maybe even Democrats don't like, right? Or maybe something about her style of campaigning or the fact that she kind of comes across as an establishment type figure to liberals, but a liberal to moderates. I mean, so I think the performance there is something that you could question.
Claire, how do you evaluate Harris's pros and cons for VP pick?
I think she's the more interesting pick. I think, you know, she does satisfy we want to have the diversity of the party showing up on the ticket. Again, she's the right age. She's a senator. I actually think she's an interesting mix of, could she appeal to progressives? Could she appeal to black voters? Because she sort of had mixed, in the primary, she was mixed on both, right? Super progressive, probably Bernie leading voters kind of said, oh, she's a cop, right? She's an ex-prosecutor. She's not actually liberal. She's a flip-flopper. And you did see some in the African-American community take, particularly younger people, I think, take umbrage with the fact that she had been a prosecutor who spent a lot of time, obviously, prosecuting young black men in particular. On the other hand, I think she has the kind of cultural tribal appeal to, let's say, like the Warren voter Democrat, who is progressive, but not like a Bernie supporter. Like Harris kind of cuts through the middle of a lot of this stuff, which I think ended up being the problem for her primary candidacy, in a primary that turned into kind of the ideological polls, quote unquote, of the party. So I actually think she's kind of interesting. I mean, I think she's a pretty, she can be a charming politician, right? Like she is good at campaigning. She's good at TV, right? So she's, to me, she's a more viable, interesting option.
She'd be good at attacking Trump and Pence, I think.
Yeah.
Motoring along here to somebody else who was mentioned during the conversation about Harris is Elizabeth Warren. Considering that we don't think there's any chance that he picks Bernie Sanders, maybe that's about as progressive as you could get for a VP pick for Biden. What are the pros and cons of that?
She's not going to happen because she and Biden don't like each other.
All right, put the kibosh on that.
I mean, I would just say that I think picking Warren would be viewed as like a confident pick by Biden. You know, there maybe there'd be some marginal benefit in terms of widening his appeal to the Sanders wing of the party, to the Warren wing of the party. Yeah, you know, she certainly would be ready to step into the job on day one. It's a little hard to imagine, but like, I don't know. It doesn't seem seem crazy to me.
Let me refine what I just said. I think that she is almost too big of a name to be his vice president because Elizabeth Warren is so associated with a particular kind of politics, which makes her quite divisive. And if you're looking for a VP pick that kind of bolsters your appeal to more people, picking someone who's a super big name who has been very controversial is quite risky. And I think people aren't looking to make risky moves when they pick VPs.
Maybe it's worth asking this question. Is there anybody that Biden could pick that would get Bernie Sanders supporters, like hardcore supporters, younger people on board with the Biden ticket, maybe other than Bernie Sanders himself?
Sure, Warren. I mean, most of the picks, honestly. I think it's really important not to like take like certain very loud voices online or whatever as being at all representative of like the kind of Bernie voters that Biden needs to get. You know, the people that feel there's some extreme grievance between Warren and Sanders, for example, are a very small segment of the Democratic electorate. And people like those who would use that as a reason not to vote for like a Biden-Warren ticket or a Biden-someone else ticket, I think is even smaller. So you should think about like the kind of normal Bernie supporters who like Bernie a lot, who were kind of lukewarm on Biden, certainly prefer him to Trump, but don't feel that motivated, right? That's like a lot more important in this argument than like hypothetically some podcaster who lives in Brooklyn or whatever. Because I'm making that sort of stereotype because like it really is like a very, very small and narrow cast segment of people that like presume that they speak for kind of like the Bernie left when they don't. With that said, I mean, I think someone like a Stacey Abrams would also have a lot of support among people on the left. So yeah, I mean, look, I think Warren is a high risk, high reward pick. She is also 70 years old, which is a little bit of a problem if you're trying to say, hey, we need someone younger in case, you know, although she seems very healthy and voters did not consider her to be a risk age-wise, whereas it did for Biden and Bernie. But, you know, but having a 70-year-old VP nominee for a 77-year-old presidential nominee might seem odd.
I do think Claire's point about how high profile Warren is a really smart point, where you wonder a little bit if the Biden campaign, let's say, you know, the brain trust is like, okay, you know what, we are going to use this VP selection to make an outreach to the Bernie wing of the party. They might, as Claire is saying, conclude that, you know what, the safest way to do that in terms of not also alienating any middle-of-the-road voters in the Midwest, basically white voters in the Midwest, is to go with someone like Tammy Baldwin, right, rather than someone like Elizabeth Warren, or, you know, Tammy Baldwin, Stacey Abrams, someone who isn't quite as high profile, and therefore there's less of a risk of alienation. Although, look, any woman who is, and Biden says he's going to pick a woman, you know, any woman who gets into the national spotlight in politics sort of de facto becomes polarizing because of sexism.
Because you all
and
hate
how
your mothers.
Politics works. And sorry, Claire.
Nothing.
I
said because you all hate your mothers. I was making a crude
exactly,
joke about
right.
why sexism doesn't make sense.
So let's move on then to Stacey Abrams, who has been widely mentioned as a possibility from the start of Joe Biden's campaign for the nomination. What are the pros and cons there? Claire, you interviewed Stacey Abrams, so why don't you take a shot at that?
Yeah, check out my interview with Stacey Abrams from, well, we recorded it in November and went up in January. Stacey Abrams is a really interesting politician on a number of fronts. I'm interested to see whether she makes it to like the top of Biden's list. First of all, she's young, which people both like and dislike. She's never been in national office with people both like and dislike, but she has become this sort of captivating figure on the left because of the fact that she didn't concede her Georgia election. She's actually kind of a pragmatic politician who shares, I think, she's not super, super left, right? I think she shares actually some ideology with Joe Biden, but she's become a kind of powerful figure of this is a, you know, a young black woman, younger black woman who is the party's future. And I think particularly for Joe Biden, if you're thinking about everyone's thinking about age, particularly in this time of coronavirus, picking someone young and vibrant and sort of maybe not tainted by a national record that could be seen as a positive. So she's sort of an interesting figure on a number of different fronts.
Do you think that he will pick somebody who's won a statewide election?
I think that, like, you know, when they're going through and looking at these people, they're talking through what the lines of attack on them are, right? So for Abrams, it's she can't even win a statewide election. For, you know, Gretchen Whitmer, who we'll talk about, it's look how controversial she is, whether or not that actually bears out in the numbers. So there's a lot of like, how much will the line of attack overwhelm that person? I mean, obviously you can't predict the future. It's hard to know, but it's certainly like, I guess Biden's super experienced, right? So maybe they feel like he can have more latitude on that side of things.
Nate, Micah, what do you guys think?
I mean, again, I don't think it's that people will be saying, oh, Biden needs a helping hand to run this or that policy directive of his. I think it's more that what if Biden does not make it through 4 years in office? So it's, to me, it's like less about kind of having one statewide office and more about kind of, I mean, they're separate things, right? One is, have you kind of withstood the rigors of an election campaign that was sufficient for you to win? Because Stacey Abrams did perfectly well relative to how you would expect a Democrat to do in a state like Georgia, right? That's like a perfectly kind of respectable performance if you're looking purely in terms of what does it say about her electorally in a good Democratic year, but still a very close election. But, you know, but do people want to have a trusted name that they think could step in on day one or day two? You know, that might be a tougher sell. I mean, look, with Abrams, you're betting kind of on the, on kind of almost her upside as like just a kind of a person, you know what I mean? Is a really impressive and smart person. But that's also kind of on the picks that would be more conventional, Klobuchar or Harris, and the picks that would be kind of higher risk, higher reward, then I think she's in the Warren category, right? I mean, that would be kind of a swing for the fences type of pick, but you know, would be unconventional in the sense of having someone who has not held statewide office before or something equivalent.
Yeah. I mean, worth mentioning when we think about how people have chosen their vice presidents, vice presidential candidates in the past, you know, like when McCain picked Sarah Palin, he was down in the polls significantly and was taking a swing for the fences kind of pick because he was worried that without something to like energize his campaign, that he would never make up that polling deficit to begin with. So maybe that is an argument more for the Klobuchar-Harris picks than the Warren Abrams. But there are more names that we could talk about, but we're just going to end with one who is taking center place in national news at the moment, and then we'll get to other names in the future. But let's talk about Gretchen Whitmer, governor of Michigan. What are the pros and cons of picking a currently nationally recognized executive who is, for better or for worse, for her own appeal, in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic fight?
I mean, I think there's a lot of upside there. She is, as I mentioned earlier, getting good marks for her handling of coronavirus, you know, going toe-to-toe with Trump on the national stage raises her profile. You know, she in 2018 ran a very like nuts and bolts, pragmatic, I think
fix the damn roads was her like, slogan.
Fix the damn roads. So, you know, that I think that kind of image could be helpful to Biden, and Michigan is a swing state. So that could be helpful. I do think it's more of a, just given her, she's relatively new on the scene, it would be more of a risk, right?
Yeah, Claire, what do you think? You mentioned Whitmer earlier as potentially having the downside of being divisive, but not necessarily.
Well, her popularity has actually been quite strong. Or her approval ratings have been quite strong during the coronavirus crisis. But I guess she has the bad luck, although maybe it's not luck, maybe there's a pattern, of having been the target of some of the president's, you know, mixed signals, at once taunting and at once sort of like, oh, we have a fine relationship. And I think, you know, in the past few days, obviously, Michigan has gotten attention for some of these, you know, right-wing protests against the government response to the pandemic. So she has become a bit more high profile, and maybe it's just inevitable that as a woman becomes more high profile in politics, or any politician, they become more divisive. But there's certainly, you know, a pro, like she could become a progressive, like, look, Trump hates this person, she must be doing something right. I like how I'm equivocating on everything. I guess it's the 538 way. But
you've learned well, Claire. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll stop talking now.
Yeah. I mean, the polling so far suggests that Whitmer is kind of winning that fight with Trump, and that her popularity is doing pretty well and his is not doing as well in Michigan. I guess the risk is that you really are owning that particular argument. And if for some reason, whenever Biden makes a selection in a couple of months, it looks like her side of the argument is not doing as well, right? Maybe in a couple of months there is more widespread calls for reopening, or maybe something about Michigan's response got screwed up. But he does have, I mean, does anyone know like what his timeline is for making this decision?
I mean, he said he's vetting potential VP picks now, but I haven't seen any reporting giving an indication as to when he would announce. Like, you know, the assumption is that it would be at a convention, but that's not obviously not necessarily going to be the case, given that the convention was moved back.
I mean, for Whitmer, I guess the risk is partly, well, she's only been in office for a year and a half or whatever, right? And is that enough? But in some ways, the profile she's gotten because of COVID and the fact that that's a very relevant experience for a governor, right? You know, that might answer some of the questions about experience. Yeah, look, I mean, I think she's kind of the, if you take Warren and Abrams as high risk, high reward, and you take Klobuchar and Harris as a bit more safe and conventional, I think she's kind of halfway in between.
All right, fair enough. Some other names that we didn't get to are, well, you mentioned Micah, Tammy Baldwin. There's also Tammy Duckworth, senator from Illinois, Catherine Cortez Masto, Michelle Lujan Grisham. There are more that we could talk about, and we will eventually, especially if he picks any of those people, we will talk about them. But as we close out here, is there any chance any chance that Biden would go back on his word and not pick a woman?
Andrew Cuomo?
I can't imagine it. What'd you say, Nate?
Andrew Cuomo. I predict that there will be an Andrew Cuomo for VP take by someone prominent within the next 4 weeks.
Has there not already been one?
We're Nate's looking at you, David Brooks.
I'm not sure how well he translates to a non-New York audience, but and that would be like, the thing about Cuomo too is he is quite, although I guess he's, you know, but he's quite moderate, right? But yeah, no, I don't think that's very likely.
Haven't we heard any like unity ticket takes like Larry Hogan, Joe Biden, or?
Oh, you'll definitely hear those takes. Yeah,
I saw a couple of those like a few weeks ago.
Do any of you want to put your bets on who he'll pick?
No.
Claire says no. I think Nate has already said that he thinks it's going to be Amy Klobuchar.
No, I did. I think Harris or I think Biden will be risk averse. And so therefore the two identified as most risk averse, Harris and Klobuchar, I think are maybe if you had to put money on two, maybe those two. And then I think Whitmer might be the third most likely. But there are a whole host of other names that are very plausible that we haven't talked about. And to some extent, if you're really risk averse, and just the fact that Gretchen Whitmer brings a lot of attributes that are, you know, could be positive or negative, you know, maybe even that seems like a bigger step than he wants to take. We've also not talking about the mechanics of like which one of these picks would entail a special election being held for a Senate seat, which is another dimension we'll talk about, I'm sure, at some later point in time.
Fair enough. Let's leave it there. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
And thank you, Micah.
Thanks, guys.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review on the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.